Name is Art Jackson, born and raised in Gladstone, Manitoba, where I received my education up to high school. After leaving high school and working for a while before joining the service, then in 1939, along with some other boys from the town, we decided to join the army, not knowing what unit to join. After arriving in Winnipeg, I decided to join the Grenadiers. At that time, they were stationed in Minto Armories, and we were boarding out at the time and doing our training during the day. Later on, we were transferred into Osborne Barracks, where we did more training, more extensive training. And our first inkling of overseas service was when we were issued tropical uniforms, unknown to us just where we were going or what we were going to do. The next thing we knew, we were on our way out of the country, heading down towards Bermuda, Jamaica. One company was dropped off in Bermuda, of which I was one of the one. And there we remained for a while on garrison duty there. After a few months, we rejoined the regiment down in Jamaica, where we spent about 16 months on garrison duty in Jamaica. Arriving back in Winnipeg for a short time, and being our barracks being the old Robinson building. From there,
Did you get leave when you came back to Winnipeg, or did you?
We had a short leave. I don't just recall how long it was, but there was a short spell of time, at which time I went back to Gladstone for 2 or 3 days. And while I was there, some of the young fellows that had joined the army since I had left and returned had already received their medical discharge from the army, unfit for service. After a short leave in Winnipeg, we were told that we were going out to the West Coast for further training and to update our training, which we hadn't had very much of while in Jamaica. While on the troop train traveling to Vancouver, I walked through the troop train, and sure enough, I saw one of the chaps that was from my hometown who had told me previously that he had medically discharged. Asked him what he was doing there. He said, "I joined the Grenadiers." This was my impression of the type of men that we picked up as reinforcements, of some of them anyway. After arriving in Vancouver, or when we arrived in Vancouver, not knowing just where we were going to be billeted, very soon we found out that the train pulled alongside the docks and we were loaded onto a boat, the old Iowatia. And from there, of course, we head out to sea, still not too sure where we were heading. The training that we got was what we could do on the deck of the boat, which was very little, because we had very little equipment with us. There was two regiments on, the Grenadiers and the Royal Rifles of Canada, and this pretty well filled the boat, so very little equipment came along with us. Our first stop was in Honolulu, in Pearl Harbor, and from there we traveled across the Pacific to Manila, and then from Manila up to Hong Kong. And during our trip across the Pacific is when we were informed as to where our final destination would be. We were also told at that time that the situation was so critical that we may even have to fight our way off the boat. Arriving in Hong Kong, with just the equipment that we could carry, we carried off ourselves. This is all the equipment we had with us, which consisted of our rifles and what have you, but very little. We were told that our supply boat was on following us. And we were billeted in Shamshapol camp, the garrison camp on the Kowloon side, in Kowloon. And we had no sooner become familiar with the surroundings than things got pretty hot there. And we also learned that that our supply boat had arrived too late, or had come too late to get into us, and had to be diverted down to Australia. So once again, we had just the supplies we had with us, plus the supplies that the colonial troops had that were stationed there at the time, which was very little. On the same day as Pearl Harbor was hit, was bombed. This was the time that they bombed Hong Kong. And then we knew we were right in the middle of everything. At this time we were still on the Kowloon side of the, on the Kowloon side in Hong Kong, and had some men up in what was known as the New Territories, along with the colonial troops that were there. But within two or three days they were forced out of there, and all troops were concentrated on the island with no hope of going anywhere. There was the army, the Japanese army coming down from the north, and boats all around the island, so there was no hope of getting off the island. And this is where some severe fighting went on. The Japanese stayed on the mainland for a while, bombing us severely, shelling the island, and at the same time dropping pamphlets to try and encourage us to give in, which the governor of the island would not do. Then under a cloud of smoke created by the Japanese with the wind in the right direction, they came across, landed on the island, and then the real hand-to-hand fighting started. To my knowledge, there was never any front line as such. You never knew where the Japanese were, if they were behind you, in front of you, or mixed with you. They were just scattered all over, and so were we, in small groups. And everybody was doing the best they could, which was very little, of course. And after a short spell of this, I can't recall just the time, the strain got so bad that the governor decided that it was a useless effort, and on Christmas Day they surrendered to the Japanese. During the time of the actual fighting, my experiences were I was connected with the headquarters of the Winnipeg Grenadiers, and I seen us go 48 hours without any sleep because of the lack of manpower. We all had to do double duty, and we were really forced to the limit. And this, of course, didn't help matters at all. After surrender, we were all gathered up in different groups. Our group had to go up to the what is known as the peak, where we joined other fellows from our regiment and some from the Royal Rifles. And two or three days were spent there. Then we were all concentrated back in Shamshapol. And as we returned back there, we noticed that it was quite noticeable that the barracks had been completely stripped of everything that was movable. When we left the barracks, there were doors and windows and beds and everything. But when we got back, there was nothing but the shell, even the window frames. Everything that was burnable was gone. I guess this was due to the fact that the Chinese that had been forced down ahead of the Japanese were desperate, and Kowloon was overloaded with refugees, and you know, nothing was sacred anymore. So this type of barracks we were put back in to make the best we could. And the food, of course, was just what the Japanese had confiscated from surrounding warehouses and supply dumps that were there, which was usually not the best. Mainly rice, which was probably moldy or wormy or full of bugs, which we used anyway. And we were also in the within this compound, the Shamshapol. There was Indian troops, Scotch troops, there was the Canadians, English. There was just quite a mixture within the garrison there. Those of us that were able to do anything at all, we were taken out to the airport to try and put the airfields back in shape. We didn't do any more than we could possibly help, but when you have someone standing over you watching you, you had to do something. But this was the main thing we did as far as labor for the Japanese was concerned. This didn't last too long for those of us, like as I say, were healthy enough. We were soon shipped off to Japan, and the ship that we went on was one that they had that had been sunk in the harbor at Hong Kong, and they refloated it without cleaning it or anything, merely draining the water out of it and making it seaworthy. And we're all, I forget how many there was, a number of us put into the hold in the boat, and off we went on our way to Japan. And we were always in fear, of course, of being torpedoed by American boats, because there was plenty along there, along the coastline at that time. Our first stop along the way was Formosa, where we took on coal, and this coal was dumped in the same hole as we were in, so it was a matter of keeping on top of the coal as it was dumped in, and there was still enough room left for us. The only time we were allowed out was for a short time during the day, when the guard would get off the lid of the hole and let us out for a little while, and then we'd be put back in, and there we'd stay. And this is how we traveled to Japan. From there we traveled by train inland, and we went to, we're encamped in a spot inland from Osaka, where our main object there was to work in the mines, as far as Japanese were concerned. And our treatment there was pretty rough, because at this time the Americans had started their drive back up from the south, and each time the Americans gained a little more ground coming back up, why, of course, we seemed to suffer. They take it out on us.
Were you aware of what was going on the outside? Like, did you get
news? At no time after arriving in Japan did we have any news, any inkling at all of how long we'd been there, whether the war was over, whether it was going to go on for the next 10 years, or just what it was. This, I'm sure, was hard on some, in the fact of those that had close relatives at home, wondering what was wrong. Another thing that occurred while in camp was the fact that within one building there was stacks and stacks of Red Cross parcels. And the Japanese at that time were living on these Red Cross parcels, and none of these were issued to us. So they were living on much better than we were in, as far as around the camp was concerned. Camp life, to me, was rugged. We were underfed, undernourished. Other than the Red Cross parcels, I kind of think the Japanese were doing the best they could. They were fighting a war. I think the biggest thing against us was the fact that we were Europeans and they were Asians. I mean, they have such a different way of living to start with. They can exist or get by on, it seems, a lot differently than we can. This is, I think, a big thing.
I've heard that the Canadian troops were respected a lot more than American troops that were prisoners of war.
Well, yes, I didn't really realize this until after you came through it all and thought about it and talked to other Americans. The Americans, the few that we did have in our camp, we didn't have too many, which meant that they had to, they were treated the same as us. Mm-hmm. And our camp, as far as the our own officials were concerned, they were Canadian officials, like Dr. Crawford was our MO, and our first man was a Canadian, which might have made the difference if the administration of the others had have been American. It might have been the reverse action. I won't know, obviously, but this is, we have very few actually Americans in the compound. But I think as far as this treatment is concerned, one instance I can recall quite well is the fact that the interpreters seemed to, especially one interpreter who was a Canadian-Japanese from Vancouver and had returned just prior to the war. Actually, he was used as an interpreter. And I think he rather resented the Canadians, and he made things pretty tough. And the fact that maybe he had a rough go here, I think, maybe he felt he hadn't.
Were you aware of that then, or you just...
Oh, yes. Yeah, we were aware of this then. Because many instances where the camp commandant would overlook something, he would press it until camp commandant was more or less obliged to do something about it. And he used to pick on a lot of petty things. And it looked as if you were just trying to get even, sort of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So these are incidents that occurred.
Were there any beatings when you were, like, did you have to witness any beatings or ill treatment?
Well, I never witnessed any beatings. I knew that there was some went on. The one thing that I did witness, and all the camp witnessed, for one chap, for some reason or other, I don't recall now, but within the compound there was sort of little reservoirs with about 3 or 4 feet of water in them. I think these were used in case of fire. I think this was what it was. And this was, it was early spring or late fall when there was just a skim of ice on it. I remember this one chap had to stand in there for about 5 hours one time with his ice bare naked, this sort of torture. I can't recall that I ever really witnessed any severe, certainly we heard about a lot of it. I recall that when we were actually taken prisoner and they were gathering up Canadians, they were wiring them together and handcuffing them together with wire and this sort of thing, you know what I mean? It was being a little rough about it, you know, but... but I can't say, there again, I suppose it's been mentioned to you before in regards to these two chaps, this one American and one English chap that were collaborating with the Japanese.
Oh, I haven't heard about that.
You haven't heard about that one? No, well, there was quite a court case when they came back.
Canadian.
I've read the newspaper.
Canadian. No, American.
No, no.
It was a British officer, wasn't he?
He was an officer. It was a kid. No, it was an American officer. No, wait, there was three of them. That's right. A Canadian, an American, and an English fellow. And they were collaborating. In fact, it was they had a big court case here that ran for pretty near a month here in Winnipeg when we came back. But this was, they were collaborating with the enemy and living off the fat of the land because of this. Now, not that we resented anybody getting more, but we felt that everybody should share and share alike at a time like this, that they were getting more, they should share it with everybody else. And at the same time, I feel that there was punishments handed out to other people because of this, because it was their benefit to do this sort of thing. And of course, another thing that when we were prisoner in Japan, I mean, the fact that you hear of Europeans over in Europe, I mean, a number of the prisoners escaped back to France and eventually back to England. We were on an island, we were in a country where we'd stand out like a sore thumb, you know what I mean? They were all different color to us, and of course, there was just no hope of escape whatsoever.
Well, you were in North Point before boys escaped, didn't you?
North Point. Yeah, this is why we were in.
Had you heard about that before? Like, did you know there was an escape coming up?
Yeah. We all knew. They didn't breeze it around. We knew if they were going to attempt it, and I think the numbers told them not to even try it, but they were determined. But this is why we're still in Hong Kong. These three chaps, of course, they didn't get very far. It was pretty hopeless. But I mean, it was a little more hopeless once you got as far as Japan to even think about it.
Yeah.
But, and again, you see, the thing that was against us too, I think, was the fact that the guards that they used while we were in Japan were fellows who had been at the front, been down through in the battle, and they had it tough, and of course they were sent back there for rest and doing this duty, and of course this all went rough for them. I mean, just didn't make a move without them.
Yeah.
But actually, I don't know what.
Some of the men have said that they used to go out at night when they were in Japan, sneak out to get food supplies, and then sneak back in again before daylight. Were you involved in any of that? Did you know that was going to be?
No, actually, I don't know. Well, I'll tell you, about the only place I could go, they had some vegetable gardens just outside the compound. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is where they went. I mean, there might have been something to do that. But the guard duty as such was fairly lax because of the fact that I think they knew that we just couldn't go anywhere. Most of the time the gates were open, so there would be two or three guards walking around the outside. I mean, you could have, if you wanted to escape, you could have gone out any time, but where would you go? This is the thing, I think they thought it was pretty safe.
Were you ever able to steal any food? Like, did that opportunity ever come up for you? I guess in a coal mine, you wouldn't ever be around?
No, no, there was no. I guess I understood from these people who were doing stevedore work and stuff like this that the opportunity present itself. But with us, I mean, it just took me the issue, and that was it. I mean, there was none other available. The only plausible chance was that one of the guards or something didn't want to order a mule sometimes. It might happen that they felt like they'd give it to you. But I mean, this was real, really. But I think myself that the big thing was that you were sort of living on your nerve the biggest part of the time, because your health, you're in such a condition, and mentally you were pretty well knocked down, you might say, because of the way the Japanese used you. It just sat living your nerve. In fact, one instance I think is rather interesting, and just how he existed. One chap that I knew pretty well in the camp, they sort of chum around with. And one evening we were sitting talking, you know, and of course the main subject for talk was, well, when are we going to go get out? What's going on? And no, none of us knew, but we used to have this in our mind all the time, I guess, and I'm not sure what we talked about, if we weren't talking about food. And this chap said to me, he says, oh, he said, this evening we're sitting down, and he said, no, he says, I don't think we're ever going to get out of this place. And the next morning, he was dead. This is just the way it happened. Once you gave up, that was it. You were just on the borderline all the time. And I know this happened with other chaps as soon as you sort of felt, well, what's the sense? And that was it.
And there was a lot of that kind of thing, wasn't there, where people began to think that the ones that died were the lucky ones?
Yeah. Well, this was it. You see, it was very depressing, very, well, it's hard to explain, really, but as I say, if you gave up, you didn't last. I mean, you were running on your nerve all the time. That's about the way it was.
It must have been incredibly monotonous after a certain amount of time, too. But.
Well, it did, in the fact that it would have, I think, if we'd have been in a camp. But the fact that we went out to the mines or were out shoveling coal or doing something, this sort of broke the routine a bit. Mm-hmm. And possibly this was good. None of us felt like it. I mean, well, physically we weren't fit to do any of it, but at least it gave you a change of atmosphere, a change of scenery sort of thing. I think if we had been confined more, then it would have been a lot worse.
Did you get any sicknesses while you were over there?
Well, I had pretty well the works over there. The malaria, jaundice, beriberi, all of it. All of it that was going.
Did you have to work when you were sick, or did you get in the hospital?
No, I was never. The only time I was in the hospital was when when I had malaria, when we were just after first taken prisoner, when I was still in Hong Kong. And I was in the hospital there for a while, but not too long before I was out of there. And once I got to Japan, of course, there was hospitals, or there was a hospital there, but just a very, very bad, where you just couldn't manage. I was never actually in the hospital at home.
Your medical officer, Dr. Crawford, was fairly well respected.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was, even by the Japanese, because and he was able to do a lot for us, in the fact that they did respect him, and I'm sure they can call him. Tried a little, to do a little more for him in this respect, getting what medicine he could. I mean, you must realize, I guess, that they were at war and things were tough too. They didn't have it. Of course, they weren't going to give us any unless they had extras, what you say. No, I think the fact that it was a man like Dr. Crawford. He did a lot for us. I mean, he was more or less helped an awful lot of the fellows get through somehow or another. But as I say, once you gave up, well, this was a pretty good thing.
Were you involved in any of the shows that they used to put on?
Not too much, no.
Did that happen much in Japan, or was that pretty much in Hong Kong?
More in Hong Kong. You see, at that time we were still in pretty good shape. I was still in Hong Kong, and mentally we were pretty well fit too, you know. But by the time you got to Japan, things got more hopeless all the time. Of course, you just went downhill. You didn't bother with much of any of that. In your spare time, you just didn't have any energy to do anything. You just sort of sat around, but didn't get involved in too much of anything. And of course, you were working while we were in the mines. You were working 7 days a week. I mean, there's no time, there's no Sundays or anything like that, as far as they're concerned.
Did you get mail? Ever get mail while you were there?
Never had any at all.
No. Did you send any home? Were they willing to take letters?
No, not to my knowledge. No. I don't know what happened in Hong Kong. I don't recall any being sent out. They may have accepted them, whether any have arrived. Of course, others could tell you about this if it actually did, but as far as I'm concerned, there was never any mail at all. No word whatsoever. I mean, this is a hard thing to, for I think sometimes for people to realize just what it's like to be absolutely cut off from everything for about 3 years. But this is the way it was. We had no news whatsoever. I think our biggest shock was when the American planes came over after the war was over. We saw these huge bombers. Well, of course, as you recall, when we were taken prisoner, they were still flying little two-man planes. These were big planes at that time, and these huge bombers, man. You know, things advanced so much during the war that we were unaware of altogether.
Yeah, I just
didn't realize it.
Did the Japanese know much, like when they dropped the atomic bombs, did the Japanese know what was going on, or did they...
Well, I'll tell you, when we look back on that instance, I recall we were at the mines at the time, on one particular day, and this must have been the time, or immediately after, or sometime in the time when the atomic bomb was dropped. Because during that day, around about noon hour, all the guards, you couldn't find a Japanese anywhere. And where were they all? In their huts, listening to radios. Now we knew something was going on, and they were nattering and chattering away to themselves in little groups, and you know, and it was all sort of hush-hush. We knew there was something, and we didn't have a clue as to what it was. Our only hope was that, you know, that peace had come, and this was it. And things were just a little different from that day on until it was actually over, because their attitude and everything seemed to calm right down. Because I think it shook them. This is what it was. I imagine a lot of them had people involved in this. And it's coming pretty close to home, of course, at that time. And I guess you just wondered what they're...
Well, I guess if you were inland, you wouldn't really know about the bombings, other than from word of mouth. You wouldn't see the bombings.
No, we saw nothing. We were too far. The only time we saw bombers when they were way up. All you could see every once in a while was a big streak of smoke in the sky, vapor in the sky, and we knew there was planes up there. But they could have been anybody's planes, for all we knew. No, we knew, we'd seen no planes, no activity whatsoever until the war was over. And the first instance we had was there was some small fighter planes came over and dropped pamphlets to let us know this is where we got our information. Because as we woke up one morning, there was no Japanese. The guys gates were wide open. No Japanese to be seen. It just disappeared overnight, sort of thing. And first thing we know, these little planes come over and they just told us that the war was over and that occupation troops were on their way in to sit tight, just stay where we were. Because we were safer inside than we were outside at this time. And I think it was either that day or the next day that the bombers came over and started dropping these drums of supplies for us. Of course, then we weren't anxious to move at all. We're getting lost to eat. And of course, it was just one. But then we just sat there until we got further information. And then our own officers took over, of course, and they got control of things. And we were told to board a train and head for Osaka. And that's the first contact we had with American troops then, was when we had landed in Osaka on the train. They actually didn't come in and in the inland as far as but they came to Osaka. And I'll never forget, of course, as I say, about seeing these planes. This was the first thing that was a real shock to us, and then everything from then on was things that had advanced so fast that it was just like moving into another world to get used to all this again. And when we land in Osaka, we get off the train, and here's a great big brass band to meet us. I'm telling you, that was the most joyful sight you've ever seen, to see this brass band, you know. And of course, they were all dressed nice and clean and neat, and we were in our scrubby old prisoner of war clothes and stuff like this, you know. And just to hear it was American men, but to hear, American music.
Yeah.
Well, that really hits you, I'm telling you.
I've heard a couple of the men say that when it actually came time to leave, that they were a little apprehensive about getting out, because even though it was a hellhole, it was where they lived, and they knew how to cope with that existence, and they were a little afraid to.
Well, this is what I think hit us. It was something hit everybody, I think, and this is probably what it was. It was just everything all at once hitting you, you know, such a big change, your system and your mind and everything had been mellowed down to a point during your internment, and then to have this all come at you all at once, you just couldn't cope with it. I mean, it just really got to you, getting away from it. And of course, then when you landed in Osaka and were cleaned up and given decent uniforms. And then, of course, they couldn't transport us out. Now we were broken up into smaller groups, and they couldn't transport anybody out immediately. So there were these big battleships sitting out in the harbor, and we went out to these. And, of course, there again, in landing barges, which were a thing that were unknown to us. We get these things, you know, it's all strange. This is new, you know. Yeah. What kind of a boat is this? But as we walked, climbed up the gangplank on these, just to show you how the Americans treat us, we climbed up the gangplank on these big battleships. There was one sailor to each prisoner of war to get on the boat, and he was assigned, and he used his cabin, his bunk or whatever, and he had to see that you got around, and he was with you all the time. This is the way they looked after us, one for one, you know.
Yeah.
And boy, they just treat us like kings, I'm telling you. Well, we spent about 3 days on there before they had planes lined up to fly us back. I was one of the more fortunate ones who was able to fly. A number of them, of course, I guess as you found out, had to come back on hospital ships and what have you because of their condition.
Well, apparently we're afraid to fly, too. That might have been.
This is another thing. Well, there again, I was young and foolish at the time, I guess, but I never thought of it, you know. But the thing that struck me, get on a plane, 40 other fellows, this thing you couldn't get off the ground, you know. This is a lot of people on a plane, you know. We don't realize this. Yeah. But I mean, here they've been doing this, and of course it was a troop transport, you know, the inside of it all gutted out. All you had is a few slings and a couple of stretchers and stuff like this. I mean, they had them, you know, they carried very little equipment, because of the fact they want to carry a lot of troops. They've been transporting troops with these. It was a B-54, I think, when they came back home. But I guess some were a little reluctant to fly, and the fact that I never really gave it a thought. I got quite a kick out of it, I rather enjoyed it. But, of course, they didn't fly us very far at a time. I think our first landing was in Iwo Jima. We held over there for 2 or 3 days. And each time we stopped, we were put into hospital barracks and treated as outpatients. We could move around, but we got treated like patients in the hospital with plenty of vitamins and good food. We didn't have to take the run of the mill along with the rest of the troops, sort of thing. I flew from Iwo Jima into Guam, and I was in Guam for about a week. Then from there to Honolulu, and we were there a couple of weeks, I guess. And this was the point where our first connection with the Canadian government. Up to this time, the Americans had been transporting us all the way. And we had, we were at the airport. There was a Canadian plane sitting there, passenger plane, and there was one of the news media, I remember a woman. She tried to persuade the airline, this Canadian airline, to forestall their passengers and fly us direct from Honolulu back to Vancouver. And they would have no part of it. They said the Americans had brought them this far, they'd take them the rest of the way. And this was our first Canadian contact with the Canadian government, and she was plenty hot, and so were we, because we wanted to get home. And so, as a result, the Americans flew us back to San Francisco. And from there, we took a troop train, and we never did see any more Canadians till we hit the Canadian border. And they took a troop train all the way up the coast before we even seen anybody.
They didn't try and get in touch with the men when you were in San Francisco?
Not to my knowledge, no. No, there was no. This was really. I mean, we were really upset about this as far as our feeling towards the Canadian authorities. They made no move and didn't seem to care. This was our attitude. They didn't seem to care whether we got home or not, sort of thing. You know, well, the Americans brought you this far, let them take you the rest of the way. This is the feeling that I got, anyway. And after arriving and coming up the coast, of course, then we went across to, it was across to Gordon Head and Vancouver Island, where we were in hospital again. And it was, it became known to us then that the reason that they were taking so long to get us home, I think, was to put us into some kind of shape before arriving back with our families, because when I left the prisoner of war camp, I weighed 90 pounds. And by the time I arrived back here in Winnipeg, I was up to 210.
Do you remember what you weighed when you left?
Oh, I was around about the same as I am now, about 145 is my usual weight. I went up to 210, and this was way overweight, of course. But, well, I can recall that we were getting so many needles, vitamin needles. Our arms are so punched full of holes that they put the needle in your arm and it would come squirting out another hole in your arm, you know what I mean? I've watched the nurse do that, and they get quite a kick out of it. This is just our arm, it's just like pin cushions when you're a pity. And of course, the vitamin pills, and it was all vitamins, and the food they gave us, of course, was all very much vitamin and putting on weight. So when we arrived back here, I guess we all looked pretty good, but it wasn't good, of course. It didn't take long to
lose. You didn't arrive as a group, did you, like you came back in tens and fifties?
Well, this is it. When I say what I'm talking about is all the way back, there was about 40 of us flying back, and I guess about the same amount up to Gordon Head, and then they filtered out from there, sort of thing. I don't just recall how many came on it. It was a special car on a train that brought us back from Vancouver to Winnipeg. No, I couldn't say with just how many it was, but. The group was sort of changing all the time. You picked up some and left some, you know, along the way. It just depended on what conditions they were in or the ship them right along. But we came back in quite small lots, of course. And of course, maybe we expected too much and we didn't stop to realize the situation, but when we arrived in Winnipeg to see our station, naturally we thought we'd be about to just come down and into the retirement to meet our families and what have you, and nothing doing. We're all shifted out to the baggage elevator, and we're down in the baggage department downstairs. Nobody was supposed to associate with, as we felt, with the people, the rest of the people that had come off the train or were in the rotunda at the time. And of course, and then we waited there, and I guess they made the announcement. Of course, the families of chaps from Hong Kong would see us in the baggage room. And I recall then, of course, figuring my sister was there and two or three of the friends from Gladstone, and I figured, well, I'd be able to go home and see you with them right away, two or three days. Nothing doing, off to 4 hours over in barracks, then the hospital.
Yeah.
We got pretty well fed up with the hospital by this time. But I guess it was all for the good. I mean, they had to keep a close check on us for a while. But this is the only time that I really spent any time in the hospital, was in Fort Osborne Barracks.
Did they, how long did it take you to get out of uniform after you got back to Winnipeg?
Let's see, we arrived back here when, you remember some dates with my name?
You arrived back here, it was a week before your birthday. So it'll be about the 13th of October.
Yeah.
And you got discharged the 19th of following June.
Yeah.
So, did you have to do army duties in that time? Or?
No. We were just sort of stalling around, sort of thing. We used to go to the barracks once in a while and report in, sort of thing. And there was medical checkups and, I think they were in a position they just didn't know what to do with us at the time. They would let us go and hang on to us. I think that's what they were trying to figure out at that time even. Eventually, of course, some of the fellows, I guess, were getting impatient. They wanted to get back to working and whatnot, and eventually they let us out. But I recall that I got my discharge on the 19th and I started work on the 20th. And I haven't missed a day to work since, so...
Touch wood.
Yeah.
Where did you work when you came back? What kind of work?
I worked for a Western grocer. And I'm still there.
Mm-hmm.
Just got my 25 years in this last year.
Did you have to fight for your, or I guess if you haven't been too sick, pension hasn't been a big problem, but I know there's been fights with the association to try and get the pensions they didn't have to get. Did you have trouble getting it?
No, I was granted a 50% pension on my discharge. This is what they was at. And then recently there was a reboard, as you recall, and this was went up to 70%.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never really gone after anymore. There again, physically, I mean, I've been able to work and everything that I feel that I wouldn't say I wasn't entitled to it, but I don't see any reason to press for any more at the present time anyway, because I really don't have, I feel that I've got my fair share out of it now. Yeah, no, it was 50% right off the bat.
Did you do it again?
No, but as I always tell everybody that looking back at it, it's a tremendous experience. It's a hard way to get it, but it's something that, in a way, you value.
Yeah.
I don't know just how to put it, but there was value in living like that to really make you think what the human being can put up with when they have to.
Yeah.
I often think of the young people today complaining and what have you. They don't know what complaining is. I mean, you know, I suppose this is a natural way for us to talk, but this is the way it is. It impressed me, it still does, that I can still see value, in even though it was hard at the time.
You think it helped you get along with people, like living in the kind of quarters you did with people you had to see every day for 4 years?
Well, this is hard to judge for me personally because of the fact that I was quite young when I went in, and I hadn't had that much contact with people prior to that. I was just at a stage where I was getting into that, and of course this all happening then. Mm-hmm. Now, so I have really nothing to judge it against, you see. Possibly it does, I don't know. But if you're older and have worked with people for a while and formed an opinion that you can't work with people or you can, and then something like this happens and all of a sudden you find you can't, well, naturally you say it was. But me, I can't say that because I was barely out of school, you might say, even when I joined up. So I hadn't had that experience really.
What I was thinking was like there must have been a pretty strong feeling of comradeship amongst the people because everybody was in the same situation and everybody was so low.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, this is true. When thinking back on that, during that particular time, there was no, what would you call it, rank difference between anybody, like your officers or your sergeants or corporals. They were just one of the boys at the time because of the fact that naturally they were relieved of their duties anyway, and they were in the same boat as we were, pretty well.
Did they carry on at all? Did they carry on the regimental system? Like, did you still have to, did you take your orders, your immediate orders from your superior officer, or did you get them straight?
No, this came pretty well as as I recall it, as a mass thing from the camp commandant. I mean, and your guards and interpreters enforced it, and it was all done through the Japanese. It didn't come from the commandant to your own officers or anything like this. It was just anything that, it was just general knowledge coming from them. Could have come from anyone, as far as that's concerned. It wasn't really that much of it. There were certain rules and regulations, and that was it. And I think the little bit of regimental end of it that did occur was probably from our previous training. I mean, when we were called out, you just sort of automatically lined up. I mean, this was, you know, nobody told you to, nobody said you had to. I mean, you just, from our previous training, automatically did this sort of thing. So that, but there was very little of that anyway, really. No, they never took many orders from anybody, really, of our own people.
Did you learn any Japanese when you were there? Or?
Well, yes, we did. It was sort of a case I have to. In many cases, we had to learn how to number in Japanese, because at bed count or any time like this, of course. Certain basic thing, knowledge, you had to have a basic knowledge of Japanese, so that when they spoke to you, you could tell almost by the tone of their voice as much as anything as what they were saying, or you know, get the meaning out of it. Because some of them, I guess, were unable to speak Canadian, and of course there wasn't always an interpreter around. And it was to your own benefit, of course, to do what they wanted or else, sort of thing. You cut with the end of a rifle or told their boot or something if you didn't do just what they wanted when they wanted it. So you sort of learned the hard way. But I think since then I've forgotten most of it. Never having used it, of course, since.
Have you been back?
Pardon?
Have you been back? No. Back any of the reunions?
No. I had thought about it when they went back to Hong Kong that time, and I thought, well, gee whiz, I don't think I really want to. And, as far as my Army days are concerned, and going back to any of these places, I think the only place I'd like to go back to is Jamaica. I'd like to be a trip back there sometime. Yeah. Of course, there's a much different atmosphere there. Much different altogether. Although it was rather odd, you know, when we were in Jamaica, as probably is known, that we were guarding internees in Jamaica. We had quite a number in an internment camp, and our main duty was to guard them. They often used to tell us that it's all right, one day you people will be in the inside and we'll be in the outside. Of course, we used to laugh at this, but it wasn't too long before we were on the inside. They weren't on the outside, but we were on the inside. I remember this quite well.
I was wondering about that. How did they get treated? Like, did they get pretty good rations in that?
In Jamaica?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes, they lived on the fat of the land. In fact, you had some very wealthy people interned there because they were big plantation owners and what have you, right on the island, you see. And of course, being German or German descent or Italian, they were interned. So they still had their servants and people bringing stuff to them all the time. They were never restricted other than the fact that they were behind wire, just to keep them enclosed. This was all. And of course, other internees that were there were ones that were taken off of boats coming in. You know, they're working on foreign boats.
Yeah.
Because it was an open port at that time. Of course, you used to get all these boats coming in. But, as I say, these plantation owners, it sounds like these millionaires, I mean, they were interned. They had to. Yeah. I suppose the same thing went on here in Canada, which we didn't know about, but a similar situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they did all right. In fact, they were living off the fat of the land there. They used to have to get up and play football for exercise.
We would have never thought of doing that. We conserved all the energy we could. Never got quite that good for you people.
That's for sure. When we were interned, by any spare time we had, we were usually just laying around trying to conserve strength. That's about all you could do. I mean,
have you ever talked to any people who were prisoners of war in Europe? Or?
No, I don't think I ever have, really. No. But as I say, I think the biggest thing against this, in comparison to the people who were prisoner of war in Europe, was the fact that they were still living among Europeans.
Yeah.
Whereas ours is a different situation right off the bat. But, they don't even think or live the way we do at all. Although I guess today they're far more Americanized or Europeanized than they used to be now.
Yeah.
Since the Americans have been in there. But you know, I've often said that with the Japanese people, they lost the war, but they sure won the peace. Because that made that country. There's no getting away from it. Since the war, they've gone ahead and leaps and bounds.
Yeah, they really have, and they've taken over.
Well, that's the mark. That's what I feel about. They lost the war, but they sure won the peace. I mean, that's just about the way it is. And they really made them.
Well, that's
no question about it.